Hey, everybody. My name is Tom, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Tom.
My sobriety date is November 22nd, 2006. I have a sponsor who I speak to every day. And I have a home group, the Buford Road Group. We meet on Wednesday night. I was just telling the gentleman here, we're still hybrid, so we still welcome participants by Zoom, but we're fully, like pretty much like you folks are here. I sponsor other guys. I think that's pretty much the bona fides. I thank Billy. He's not here, but he called me. He says, you know, I hate to tell you this, Tom, but I'm not going to be there for you. And I said, that's okay, Billy. We'll catch up some other time. And Sam's been very kind to me, touched base with me this morning, reminded me that I should be here. I don't think I would have forgot, but it was, I always appreciate that. You know, I'm amazed at how long I've been around these rooms. But, you know, the thing is that there's people that are around me that have been around longer than I am. They keep me humble. And very recently, there was a person who came in about 4 years before I did. And when we came back together again after being strictly on Zoom for a period of time, she walked up to me and she presented me with one of these. And it's a badge, and it says AA Police, Traditions Violation Bureau. And I thought, wow, that's great. And she says, well, that's okay. You're not as bad as you used to be. But my sponsor tells me I never get cured of this thing. And all I got to do is wake up and listen to my head. It reminds me that all the time, especially today and today's days with politics are right, you know, going on. Guys come on, they talk, and I start having conversations with that person in my head, you know. And after a period of time, you know, I'll hear somebody say, you know, this, that person's coming to town, you know, if you want to have something to say. And my head goes, you know, if he wants to hear me, he knows where to find me, you know. So the kind of person I am. Anyway, kind of wait for God to kick in here. And as I know, if I put him in charge, it's going to go a whole lot better than if I try to run things. I've been running through a period of uncertainty lately, and I couldn't figure out what was going on. And I picked up one of my spiritual readings, and it talked about exactly what I was going on. I'm in great danger if I spend an enormous amount of time planning, you know, everything that's going to happen today, tomorrow, and in the future. And I was like, oh my God, that's exactly what I'm doing. And that's exactly where I'll go to if I don't keep coming to these rooms and I don't keep being around good folks like you, because it's like my sponsor says, I never get cured of this thing. You know, I walked into these rooms and I was essentially a straight bourbon drinker. I was a straight bourbon drinker, you know, period. I went through a little bit before I got there. Early on, when I was younger, I just couldn't, and I hope I don't offend anybody, but I just couldn't tolerate the beer. Well, it wasn't I couldn't tolerate the beer. I just didn't have the capacity that some folks had. I mean, I could, it's not that I didn't like the taste of beer. It was good and it was refreshing, but it just, I would fill up before I could get where I wanted to be. And wine, I like wine too, but I always get a headache. And one of the things is the bourbon just always took me exactly where I wanted to be very quickly. And I didn't have to have a great capacity because it does work very well for me. I don't remember my first drink, but I do remember my first drunk. And actually it was with bourbon. And it wasn't, you know, that wasn't something that I planned. I just happened to get to, you know, I spirited this bottle filled with bourbon out to a bunch of friends of mine, and we went out in the woods and sat there and drank the thing. And I pretty much drank most of it because they took their first hit and kept passing it on. And like a good alcoholic, I made sure that the thing was bone dry before that bottle hit the ground. I don't remember exactly how I got home that day. I thought maybe somebody carried me home, but all my friends assured me that I climbed on my bike. This is 13 years old. I climbed on my bike. And I made it home, and I never had anybody say anything about how they had to carry me home. I woke up on my parents' sofa, and the interesting things that interest me now that didn't at that time was, one, I have no clue to this day how I ever got home. I was blacking out way back then. And the other thing was, is that I made sure that, that bottle was dry. I mean, I brought that bottle full of booze. I wasn't going to waste any of it. That's kind of the way my drinking career was, on and off. I mean, I wasn't every day drinker after that period of time, because I was focused in on trying to get an education, and I was blessed with some athletic ability. So, you know, sports kept me out of trouble for a good period of time. So I didn't drink a whole lot growing up. I didn't until I got into college. And I wasn't really crazy about beer and wine, and it seemed like that's what everybody else around me was drinking. And I went to this this function, and I was offered a beer. No, I don't want to think so. And this guy said, "Well, how about a martini?" I went, "No, I don't think so. I'm not really a great scotch or bourbon. I mean, a vodka drinker." And he said, "Well, how about a Manhattan?" And I said, "What's that?" He said, "Well, it's a bourbon martini." And I said, "Is it any good?" He goes, "Oh yeah, I think you'll like it." And so I said, "All right, I'll try." And that was my downfall, because that from that moment on, I was in pursuit of the greatest Manhattan that was available. And I went through a lot of different things and trying to find, you know, who could make the best one. And I finally did. I found somebody who could make that just exactly the way I wanted. It wasn't too sweet. It wasn't too bitter. It was just perfect. And I followed him back to the bar, and I got to the bartender and asked him exactly what it was. And he told me the ingredients was Wild Turkey 101. And he made a point of saying not 80, not anything else. And so that's what I had to have from then on, was Wild Turkey 101. And for a long period of time, I would have pointed to that as a reason why I wasn't an alcoholic, because I would have told you, and I would have thought in all honesty, when I first came into these rooms, that, you know, I drank only Wild Turkey 101. You know, if they didn't have that, I would maybe accept Maker's Mark. And if they didn't have that, then I would drink Blackjack. But if I didn't have that, I wouldn't drink. And all that was a lie, because there wasn't any place you could go to, I thought, that they didn't have one of those three. So I found out that early on, I was out with a girl one time, and we were down South Carolina and went to some honky tonk. It was just a country western, you know, singing, dancing type of thing. And I went to get a couple of drinks, and I asked her what she wanted. She said, "Just give me a, you know, white Zinfandel. What if they don't have Zinfandel? Just give me a white wine. I don't care." So I went up there and I ordered one white wine and one Wild Turkey Manhattan on the rocks. And the guy said, "What the heck is that?" And I said, it's a Manhattan. Hey, you got get your Wild Turkey out. I'll show you how to make it." And he goes, "Well, we don't have Wild Turkey. You got Maker's Mark? No. How about Jack Daniel? You got Jack Daniels, don't you? No. What do you got? Beer and wine. That's all you got is beer and wine?" He says, "Yeah, that's all we got in this place tonight." I said, "Okay, well," I went to my girlfriend. I said, "We got to leave." And she says, "What are you talking about? We just got here having fun, you know." And I said, "They don't got any bourbon here." And she says, "Well, you go ahead. I'm staying." So I stayed. I drank beer. I wasn't crazy about it, but I did what I needed to do to stay where I had to be. I went through periods of time where I drank, I didn't drink, and everything else. And I don't really remember exactly when it started becoming an issue for everybody else other than me. But I do remember the first time that it was ever brought to my attention that somebody had a problem with the way I was drinking. And the girl I was living with, she had gone out to my workshop to get a screwdriver, and she came back in and she held up this half bottle of Wild Turkey. And she says, "What's this doing out in your workshop?" And I had no clue. And I just went, "I don't know, but thanks. I've been looking for that everywhere." And I thought that was pretty funny. And she just looked at me with great concern. And I thought, you know, that's not really good. I need to do something about that. So I went to pints, and I started drinking pints, because you could hide them a whole lot better than a fifth. And And that worked a while until one day she came home and I was half tank sitting in my easy chair. And she said, "What's that empty bottle or pint of Wild Turkey doing on the truck, the tailgate of your truck?" And I just went, "I don't know." And like, who else is going to put, you know, somebody had must have put it there. I don't know how it got there. Well, it was just her, me, and the dogs and the cats. I mean, that's the only one. It had to be me. But that was the best I had to offer. I don't know. So I went down to mini bottles. And mini bottles were great because I could fill the console of my truck with mini bottles. And I could drive down the road, take one, uncork it, toss it down, put the cap back on, and throw it out the window. Evidence gone. Everything's good. I manage Metro. Nobody's going to surprise me again with a bottle, wanting to know where it came from. And I'm just going to carefully drink what I need to drink. You know, that really didn't work too well. You know, I've had people come up to me and say, "Do you realize that was probably the most expensive way to drink?" And I said, "Yeah, it didn't matter. That wasn't my focus. My focus was, how can I drink safely without getting caught? How can I drink safely in a way that nobody's going to be worried about what's going on with me?" And that was my solution to the problem at the time. You know, fill up my console with Wild Turkey 101 mini bottles, and I could go anywhere and do whatever I want. And that seemed to work for a while. And I would have told you, too, that I never had any major consequences as a result of my drink. I would have told you, and this is true, I never had any DUI. I never had any drunk in public. I never lost a job. I never lost a house. I never lost a family member because of drinking. And I would have said that in all honesty, but the truth of the matter is that that is also a lie. The first major consequence of my drinking was when my son came over one day, and we're standing out in the garage. Garage doors open. We're standing at the entrance of the garage because I can smoke out there. And he's standing there sipping on his Pepsi. He's 25-year-old boy, male man. I'm sitting there having a conversation with him. We're debating politics of the day, one of our most favorite things to do. And because we're usually on opposite sides of the spectrum on that. And I'm tossing down mini bottles and smoking my cigarette, and he's drinking and sipping on Pepsi. And I caught him in a logical argument that we were having, and he knew I caught him, and he didn't know what to say. And with frustration, he swung his fist and said, "Damn," or something like that. And I don't know what it is to this day, but that set me off. And I grabbed him, this 25-year-old man, I grabbed him, shoved him across the garage door floor, slammed him into the wall, and I was seething in his face. And I mean, I was just absolutely as angry as any person could be. Why? I have no idea. And what he was looking at was a monster. And he was trying to reach him. He's trying to say, Dad, it's me, it's me. I mean, I remember hearing those words now, but it was having no effect at the time. The only thing was going was my anger and rage was just increasing. And I found out later that he was absolutely in fear of his life that night. And I don't blame him. I understand why. And I don't know what it was. I do now. I do have a belief now that it was God that reached down and broke that hold. But I don't, you know, it just did. And now anybody in their right mind, I mean, he's a good kid. He's a great kid. He's always been a great kid. He's a great guy now. He's 43 years old. And anybody would have begged for forgiveness at that point in time. "Please, you know, forgive me for what I've just done to you." And I didn't. I stepped back and I just looked at him with absolute disdain. And I said, "Get the F out of here." And I'll never forget this. I mean, his head dropped and he reached down and he picked up whatever he had in his hands. He walked slowly to the edge of the garage. He got in his car and he drove off. Within a minute, I realized, you know, what I had just done. And I picked up the phone and I called him and went to voicemail. I recalled him again. He wouldn't answer the phone. I left a voicemail. "Please call me. Please forgive me. I can't believe I did. Please call me back." For the next 15 months, I never heard from him. He wouldn't take my calls. He wouldn't be anywhere where I was rumored to be. He wouldn't respond to emails. He didn't want anything to do with me. He was saving himself, is what he was doing. I mean, and I understand that now, and I can appreciate what he was doing. He was doing the right thing for himself. But at the time, it was just, it was heartbreaking. It was just really, really hard. My daughter, she wasn't coming around much either. She was 30, she was 2 years younger than he was. So she was 23 at the time. And she would take my calls. If I asked to get together with her to do something, she would, but she wasn't voluntarily coming around. In fact, what I didn't realize was that she was talking to the woman that I was living with at the time, and she was saying, "What are you doing with this guy? You know, he's my dad and I love him, but he treats you like dirt. But what are you doing with him?" And what I didn't realize is two things. One, I didn't realize that conversation was going on. Second, I didn't realize that she was listening to that conversation. And she's a smart woman. She's a smart person. You know, she's got, you know, realizing, you know, I don't know what I'm doing. I've done everything I can help this guy. And of course, at the time, I mean, I look back and I think of all the things that she desperately was trying to do to help me, because I was sinking. I was just sinking. But at the time, all I could see was somebody trying to control me. I mean, that's all I saw from her. She's just, you know, she's telling lies. She's saying, "I didn't do those things." Well, I did. But at the time, I didn't see it. All I saw was somebody trying to control me. And so I told her whatever she needed to hear, you know, so that she could leave me alone. And that was working okay until one day she came. She said, "We're getting ready to go to work." And we both were professionals. I got finished first. I was getting ready to leave to head out the door. And she came out and she said, "Can I talk to you for a minute? Or do you have to rush off? Do you have to get to me?" I said, "No, I'm good. I don't have anything scheduled for a couple hours. Like, I'm good. What do you need?" She says, "Well, just sit down for me." I said, "Okay." She sits down. She looks at me with just absolute tenderness and love in her heart. She says, "Tom, I love you with all my heart. I want to grow old with you. There's nobody else I want. But you're killing yourself. And I can't sit here and watch it anymore. I've tried everything I can to help you. You just won't listen." And I sat there and I looked at her. And inside my head is just absolute rage. And I'm thinking, how could you do this? How could you do this to me? How could she do this to me? Never mind what I did to her. I mean, our book says very clearly in the family afterwards, it says, you know, that any person exposed to an alcoholic for the number of years they are, you know, his life will be, you know, neurotic. And so I cannot imagine what the impact was living with somebody like me. And I just looked at her with disbelief, and I said, "Okay, and I got up and left, and I got out of my car, my truck, and I'm going to work, and I'm driving." And the second thought that comes in my head is, "Good, now I can drink in peace. Go, fine, I don't need you. Get out of here." That's what I'm talking to her, you know, in my head as I'm driving to work. And I get to work, and I think it's the second time that God reaches down and says, "Tom, this person is all you got left. You know, your children aren't coming around. You haven't seen your son in God knows how long. The people that you work with don't come around you. I mean, I had people that reported to me that were in the next office and the office across the way. And I'm 30, 40 feet away. Not to mention the people that are in the next office, and they're communicating with me by calling on the phone or on email because they don't want to be in my presence. It's just not a really good winning situation that they're in. But I don't see any of that's going on. I mean, all I'm seeing is, you know, what everybody is doing to me. that I would never do this to you. Anyway, the thought comes into my head, okay, you know, you're losing everything that's of any value to you. You better do something. So I pick up the phone and I call her and I said, look, I understand what you're saying. I understand what you want to do. If that's really what you want to do, okay. But I'm going to get help. And she says, well, what are you going to do? And I said, I don't know, but I'm going to find some help. And she starts saying, well, have you thought of everybody else around you? I can't talk to you about that now. So I went home later and I said, okay, I think I've got this figured out. And she said, well, I think I have a solution for you. And I'm the type of guy that hates whiners. They're complaining about their lot in life, that this life isn't treating them well, that they're not getting exactly what they, you know, I have people like that coming at me all day long that they work for me. And my favorite thing to do was to tell these people, well, you know, throw it back on them and say, what do you suggest? And most of them, you know, had no clue. They just were expecting somebody to do something for them. They had no idea in terms of what a solution was to their problem. And it always worked. They tuck tail and go the other way. So when she's telling me I got to do something, I pull that out of my kit and I said, well, what do you suggest? And she goes, well, how about AA? And I go, no, I don't think it's that bad. I don't even know what AA is, but it can't be that bad. And she said, well, you've got to do something because I just can't tolerate this anymore. And if you want me to stay, you're going to have to do something. I said, I got it. I said, I'll call Jeff. Jeff is a friend of mine who's a psychiatrist. And I said, I'll call Jeff and I'll ask him if he can recommend somebody for me to go talk to. So he gives me the name of a alcohol and drug counselor. I go sit and talk with this guy. And I spend, I don't know how much time telling him about my problems and my woes. And I stop and I says, so what do you think? And he says, have you thought about AA? And I'm thinking, when did he talk to her? I mean, why would you be saying that? Did you talk to my wife? No. Oh, that's a lie. I mean, I didn't tell him that, but that's just my head. How would he have come up with that without talking to her? But that's where my head's going. And I said, no, I'm going to pay you. You're going to help me. And he said, okay, we can see how this goes for a while. So I start meeting with him. And in my head, I'm thinking, I just need a jump start. You know, I just need to get a running start here. You know, maybe a week or 2 weeks or 3 weeks, just something. At that point in time, I tried everything I could to control this thing and nothing was working. So I just, okay, you're going to help me get going here. I just need somebody to give me a running start. Okay. So I started meeting with him. And I go, a week goes by, no drinking. 2 weeks go by, no drinking. Maybe three, I don't remember. But, you know, all of a sudden the thoughts in my head is, see, I just needed a running start. And what's worse is everybody else is paranoid about this thing and I'm buying into their paranoia. I know what the answer is. I'll just drink on weekends. You know, how could anybody object to somebody drinking on the weekend? If I work all week and weekends come around, you know, it seemed to me that's a pretty simple, reasonable solution. So I started drinking on Saturdays and Sundays. And then I think before the first week was up, I realized that I was cheating myself because Friday's part of the weekend. You get off work, weekend starts. So I started drinking Friday night, Saturday, Sunday. Football season, Monday night football is part of the weekend. And I was finding everything I could to add another day here or there. I don't ever think I got to looking at Thursday as Friday Eve, but that probably would have sounded good to me at the time. And before I knew it, I'm drinking every day except the day that I'm going to see the counselor. And a thought occurs to me that that's kind of stupid. And so what I do is I stop at the ABC store and I get a handful of mini bottles and I put them in my console for when I come out. And so I go to my meeting with him. I come out and I drink on the way. Now I'm drinking every day. And I think I've got it under control, and I think I'm managing it, and I think I'm hiding it from everybody. And I'm telling this guy I'm not drinking. And I get to the point where I'm going to his sessions, and I'm thinking just one mini bottle to take the edge off, make the session go better. One turns into two. Before I know it, three, four, you know, whatever. And I'm still going to this thing. And that's kind of the way things keep going for me. And it's just right back into the whole thing of just drinking every single day. And I'm thinking I'm getting away with it. And it goes like that for a period of time. And until the Tuesday before Thanksgiving 2006. And we were getting ready. She and I were getting ready to go to Columbia, South Carolina to visit her folks. And Thanksgiving. The good part was, because of our work schedules, we weren't going to be able to drive together. We were going to have to drive separately. And I'm thinking, I can drink on the way down. So Tuesday comes, I take off work early because I have two dogs, and long-haired dogs, Shelties, and I'm going to take them with us, and I'm going to give them baths before I take them to the in-laws. And so I go home. On the way home, I stop. I get a 12-pack of mini bottles, empty them into my console. This is for tomorrow. This isn't tonight. I'm not drinking tonight. And I go home, and I get the first dog. I get this, it's called a place called Critter Town. It's a do-it-yourself dog wash. They provide the whole thing. You just pay a fee, you go in, use their tubs and everything. It's great. But with a long-haired dog like Shelty, it's about an hour and a half job. And I'm thinking, you know, it's a hard, I got two of these to do. And I look at the first dog I'm taking, and I think, you know, one mini bottle, just a mini bottle, just take the edge off it. This is an hour and a half job. Well, one turns into two. And I get him done, and I get him in the truck, and I take him home, and I pick up his brother, and I put him in the truck, and I'm driving. And I look at the dog now that I've got, and I say, your brother got too many bottles. You deserve too many bottles. Somehow or another, by the time I took that dog home, the 12-pack is gone. I'm in trouble because I got to drive tomorrow and I got no booze. So I stop at the ABC store, buy a second 12-pack. I got errands to run. And while I'm running the errands, doing whatever I got to do, I got to take care of things for my dad. I got on and on. The second 12-pack of mini bottles is gone. So I buy a third one, and that's for tomorrow. Now, I'm not going to drink any more of these, but by the time I get home, I'm so intoxicated that I'm standing in the kitchen. I'm just barely standing up. She walks in and she looks at me and says, you're drunk. Now, I've been in AA by this time for about a year and a half or so, you know. And she looks at me and she says, you're drunk. And I said, yeah, but it's okay. It's okay. I'm not an alcoholic. And her mouth just opens and the tears start welling up. And I said, no, you don't understand. You don't go to the meetings. You don't hear what these people do. I don't do the things they do. I've never had a DUI. I've never been in jail. I've never this. I've never that. All these different things that I'm telling her, you don't understand. You're not around these people. She just starts crying, and she just runs to the back of the house. I mean, she knew I was drinking at that time. But for somebody like her, she had hope. Because I was still saying I'm an alcoholic. And she understood that it was hard to get over this, but I was still saying I was an alcoholic. That's what you want to hear. I'm Tom, an alcoholic. Yeah. But I never did, you know, admit it to myself. I always thought, you know, I'm going to beat this thing and then I can be just a normal person. I can drink the way I want to. I just got to figure this out. Well, I had just ripped away from her the last vestiges of hope that she had. because I was now telling her I wasn't an alcoholic and there was no place to go. As far as she was concerned, that was the end of the line. So she goes in and slams the door. Fine, I won't beat you around. Be around me. I won't be around you. So I go in the other room and I slam the door. I close, you know, to make sure that she hears it good and loud. And I collapse down on the floor. And I sit there and I think about this and I go, okay, so you're an alcoholic. You know, God's pretty good. He's been pretty good to me for a lot of years. It was that. That's all he needed to help me. You know, the book is very clear, and it says, you know, we had to concede to our innermost self that we were true alcoholics. And until that actually occurs, it's, you know, everything else is pointless. I mean, for 15 months, I'm going through this program, but nothing was working because until that period of time, I had not conceded that I was an alcoholic. And it was at that moment in time. And I was just sitting there and I thought, fine, I'm an alcoholic. I can't go through this anymore. And what I meant was I can't get up and debase myself and go pick another white chip up. I just can't do that. I'm going to end up dying drunk. And there was a voice that came in my head, was as clear as it be, and said, yes, you are. You are an alcoholic. But you are going to pick yourself up, dust yourself off, and move forward. And I can't explain to you why. I mean, as intoxicated as I was at that moment in time, I knew I was done. I can't tell you why I knew. I just did. I knew that I was done. And since that time, I mean, many years ago, I have not had a need to go back and drink. And there's been a lot of things that happened in my life. But, you know, I slowly started getting involved with AA. I don't remember the first 6 months, but after a period of time, the sponsor I was working with called me and said that he needed me to find somebody else to work with because he just didn't have the time to devote to me that I deserved. I think translation, I don't want to deal with your crap anymore is probably more what it was like. But I went and I asked another guy to help me and he got me involved and started, you know, he just got me involved in the path. He started, you know, somebody, hey, we need some, Tom will do it. Wait a minute. You didn't ask me. You're this right. I didn't. You want to argue about it? No. Okay. You'll do it. So and that was good. I mean, except for when it came to things that really mattered, like being designated group GSR. You know, what's that? Don't worry about it. Just say yes. Okay. That led to a district position as treasurer. Then it's just one thing after another, intergroup, everything else. I didn't want to do any of those things. But fortunately, I had a sponsor that was raising my hand every time something came up. And I needed that because I don't volunteer for things. I just don't. I'd rather be home sitting on my deck with my wild turkey and my dogs and just leave me alone. But he kept pushing me. He kept getting me involved and things started getting better. And he's asked, I will tell you that he's asked a lot of me over the years. Some of you know who he is, so you know he's kind of an interesting guy. He was back in the, he's a lot more relaxed today. Back then he was a Nazi. At least I thought he was a Nazi. But he wasn't. He was just deadly serious about this thing. And to this day, he's still deadly serious about this thing. And he's been sober 28 years. And it's part of his, because of what he does. He speaks to his sponsor every single day. When I heard that about 8 years ago, I went, whoa, if that's good enough for him, it's good enough for me. And so I speak to my sponsor every day. And all the things that he's asked me to do, I can't tell you that I've gone, yeah, it's a really good idea. But he's asked me to do a lot, but I can tell you this, not one single thing that he's ever asked me to do has harmed me. And absolutely everything that he's done has helped me. And you know, the thing about it is that some of the things that really happened that were really good was that my son came back into my life. He just, and to this day, when something happens, it's exciting for him. He wants to call and talk to his dad. My daughter, who, you know, flew away, she gave me my first grandchild. And the day that that came was just one that I'll remember. It's kind of like, you know, what happened with my son in that garage. I never want to forget that. I never want to forget the first day of my first grandchild. We're sitting there waiting for the glorious event to happen. And it's myself and Sharon and my ex-wife and my son-in-law has two parents. And they come out and they say, oh, everything's fine. Baby's born. You guys can go back one at a time for a few minutes. Just go one at a time. And everybody's looking around, who's going to go? And I just said, you know what? Let the mothers go first. And so the three women went first, one at a time. And then it got down to me and the father-in-law. And I said, Dad, go ahead. Well, timing is everything. Because when I walked in there, by the time I walked in, there's a room that was, you know, there's a bed over here that my daughter was propped up in. Her husband was standing next to her, holding her hand. Over across the room was the delivery nurse cleaning up my grandson. And she gets him cleaned up and blanket and everything, comes walking over and said, who wants to be the first one to hold him? And my daughter goes, he does, points to me. I don't deserve that. But I only have that because of this room, the program that we have here, which has taught me to get involved with a God of my understanding that I never thought was possible, because I was angry at God for a very, very long time. But I had a good sponsor who kept me going. You know, I like to tell you that everything was great, but life came to visit in a big way. You know, I was in my seventh year of sobriety, and it was the worst year of my life. Who I called my father-in-law at the time died. Two of the dogs died, and everybody knows me about dogs knows that they're like kids to me. My brother, who was one of us, but couldn't seem to make it in these rooms to stay, he died. This thing killed him. He was my best friend all my life. There were other losses, but the greatest thing was that Sharon came to me at one time and just said, I got to get away from you for a while. I'm 7 years sober. And that's what my sponsor means, that I never get cured of this thing. But she got to the point where she just had to save herself. And I understand it now. We still have a solid relationship, probably more so than we ever had before. But one of the most important things that happened to me during these years was my sponsor, because the night that she walked out and I thought my life was over. It was a Wednesday. It was my home group. And I just closed the windows and I sat in my dark den and I called my sponsor. I told him everything that happened. And I said, I can't come tonight. I just can't. This is killing me. And he said, I understand. I'm going to ask you to come anyway. And I said, yeah, Alex, he said, tell you what, come. If this isn't better than what you're doing now, you know, I won't bother you anymore. But come. I said, okay, I'll come. He said, all right, you can't tell anybody what's going on. And you stick out your hand to every person that comes up. You shake their hand, you smile at them, you ask them how their life's going. You don't tell them anything about what's going on with you. And I just couldn't imagine that, because I wanted to tell everybody what, you know, how unfairly I was being treated. And he knew better. He didn't want, you know, me to lay that on everybody else. So I did. And he was right. I mean, I felt better at the end of that night. Now, I wasn't 100% better, but it was a lot better than when I was sitting in the room at home. And he, you know, he got me involved in ways that with AA in ways that I couldn't possibly imagine. He encouraged me to keep seeking God in a way that I'd never done before. And that set me on a path that has been another journey into itself that has opened up a pathway and a relationship with a God that I don't understand, but in a way that just is absolutely unbelievable. There's just not enough time to explain all the great things that have happened to me in this in these 7 or 8 years. Now, I don't mind telling you that I'm very happy where I am at this point in time, and I'm glad to be. I wouldn't want to go back and volunteer for this. But compared to where I was and some of the times over the last 7 years when things were getting really bad, I had a good sponsor was saying, just think how much better it would be with a couple of shots of wild turkey. Well, I didn't even have to think about what that meant. I, you know, Sam said when I'm done.